Very special event with Kathy Kanaia and Sanjoy Roy, who will be having a conversation after I shortly and briefly introduce them. But first of all, thank you to the Arts Council who make this possible. French Indian poet, dance producer Kathy Kanaia calls herself a portmanteau person, like sofa beds and motels. Author of 4 books, she was also the principal scriptwriter of Desh, choreographer Akram Khan's dance production. Until the Lions, from which she will be reading today, is her reimagining of the Mahabharata in multiple voices. It won the 2015 Tata Literature Life Award for Book of the Year in Fiction. In Naya's resume, as a dance enabler, one finds mention of Sidi Larbi Sharkawi, Damien Jallet, 2 Olivia Award-winning productions, the Louvre Museum, the Viet, Shaolin Warrior Monks, Misadventures with Ninja Swords and Elephants, among others, many of which materialize in her poetry. And now, Sanjoy Roy. Sanjoy has been writing on dance since 1994 for various publications such as Dance Gazette, Dance International, Dancing Times, and also for The Guardian since 2002. The biggest single project was The Guardian's Step-by-Step Guides from 2008 to 2011, a series of entertaining, informative profiles of companies and choreographers. More recently, he has also led writing workshops, taught university classes, been a judge for the Place Prize in London, the PECTA Choreography Award in India, and the Premio Equilibrio in Rome. I hope you enjoy their conversation. I can't wait. Let's welcome them again.
Listen, listen, this neither begins nor ends with me. Not such a hate cascading down time, crossing sea and sky and continent. A hate that sails beside friendship, love, fealty, so many skiffs. I could not say where it began, perhaps only the stars can. For beginnings come clothed in mist. There are many who will claim to know, Vyasa foremost, but even saintly bards, especially when sons, don't allow tales to travel unadorned. And so I must uncage the quieter lore, let them wander, rags and slander notwithstanding. There may be rhyme, but not much reason, little meter, but both stress and distress. This is not the whole story, nor a lyrical history of mankind. It is what I know to be mine, true or nearly so, perhaps not at all at times, for truth is a beast more wayward than time.
Okay, so that was the opening of one of the voices that weaves through this book called Until the Lions. Kartika has the Indian edition, I have the English one. It's spoken by a character called Satyavati, who is the mother of a sage called Vyasa. Vyasa is the, in Indian mythology, is the writer, the scribe of an epic cycle of myths called the Mahabharata. And given that this is called Echoes from the Mahabharata, I thought the way to start would be just to give you a tiny bit of context. It's the Mahabharata is it's reputedly the longest written epic in the world. It's certainly longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey combined. It tells the story in outline of a dynastic struggle, and it culminates in a battlefield, in a war, essentially, a Pyrrhic war in which there really are no winners. Everyone's a loser. I'm I'm not deeply familiar with the Mahabharata, but from the things that I've read, the things that struck me most were it has a very unflinching gaze on its stories. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of duplicity. It's very much about political machinations implicated with structures of kinship and hierarchies of social hierarchies. Mm-hmm. And one of the disturbing things about it, which is, you know, one of the best things, is it doesn't offer very much moral compass. It actually undermines quite a lot of it. It's actually hard to tell who are the good guys and who are the bad, including the gods. It actually is quite a forceful set of stories when you start getting involved in it. It has the power, the kind of sweep of myth. But unlike the other great Indian epic, the Ramayana, it kind of undermines a moral sense for me. So I'm going to ask Kartika, one, given that this is, you know, the longest epic in the world, what on earth possessed her to approach it in book form? How did she think she could take it on? And two, maybe about your own particular, consequent to that, about your own particular entry points into the myth cycle. I should say that this book is... You can say this about the book is a series of voices of characters from the Mahabharata, but you can say a little more about them.
Yeah, taking it on, I think it's sheer foolhardiness, because when I started, I had no idea what I was getting into to an extent. My Indian publisher and I thought, you know, when I told her about it, she thought it was a great idea, and she actually marked it in her diary for publishing in 2012. I took 5 years. By 2012, I had barely, you know, I can't say I finished researching it, because that went on right till the end, but I barely sort of completed a certain amount of reading and started structuring the writing of it. So, yes, I mean, it's one of those things which you wonder in retrospect if you would have done if you'd known what exactly it implied. And you asked me what the entry point was. That's kind of interesting because, like I mentioned, A.K. Ramanujan, the Indian poet and translator and great scholar, once said that you never hear the Mahabharata or the Ramayana for the first time. It's sort of there in the collective subconsciousness. And that's probably true to a certain extent, irrespective of which, you know, religion or region you belong to. Again, I say to a certain extent, because it's so steeped in a certain ethos, whether it's in language, there are proverbs that are linked to characters or incidents. You know, there will be references in theater. In fact, my first real memory of it would be from Kathakali, from dance theater, which I suppose is prophetic in a way. But what made me decide to take it on? Two triggers, one positive and negative. One was, again, as Ramanujan said, there have always been tellings and retellings from, say, around, you know, the 2nd century BCE. Bhasa adapted it for theater again, so we find that it's had a very lively presence beyond text. It's, you know, been there in performing art. So there's always been retellings, and I read a very contemporary one, which was fascinating in many respects, but also terribly annoying because it kind of upended the narrative in a very binary way, and that annoyed me, because what I like about the Mahabharata is that there are so many shades of grey.
In what way did it upend the narrative?
Well, you know, the good guys became the bad guys. To begin with, you know, in the Mahabharata itself, you're never sure who the good guys and the bad guys are. So to have it simplified to that extent was a bit annoying, perfectly legitimate, because I think everybody can have a take on it. But it was annoying. And then I remembered, you know, it kind of was a bit of a thorn. It stayed with me. So it was an interesting rewriting in the sense that it didn't go away. So it stayed with me long enough for me to wonder what, you know, what how one could approach it other ways. And the positive trigger was this.
So it kind of annoyed you enough,
yes,
to make you want to do something about it. Okay.
And the positive trigger was this incredible collection of poetry, which is actually one long epic poem by, it's called Sarpasatra, and it's I think it's available in the UK. So it tells the story from the other end, from the creatures that nobody thinks of, the creatures who actually begin and end the Mahabharata, the serpents who are sacrificed. At the Sarpasatra, at this ginormous snake sacrifice that one of the descendants of the Pandavas, who win the Kurukshetra war, conducts in order to avenge his father. So it's the tale of the snakes who are being killed. You know, that's
okay.
Yeah. It's by Arun Kolatkar, and it is an incredible piece of poetry. And so I had the entire spectrum before me as to just what one could do with it. And I thought it would be, everything's been done. But what was interesting for me was to have an intersection of gazes of the obvious winners, the obvious losers, and actually the people who were the victims behind all this, the ones who were interested neither in winning nor in losing, but just get caught up, the collateral of war or power.
Okay. So is there not a saying from the Mahabharata about what is here will... what is not here cannot be found elsewhere?
To paraphrase that? It's basically everything that's, every tale in the world is contained here, and what is not here is not found elsewhere.
So your tale can just fit into one of those things that can be found in Mahabharata.
Yes, it's just another retelling. The only thing is that it is a retelling by, originally it was meant to be by 18 voices, 18 being a number that's recurring in the Mahabharata for many reasons. One, that the epic is contained in 18 books, which then are divided into chapters and sub-chapters and so on and so forth. But it's 18 books that constitute the Mahabharata. And the dramatic thrust of the entire epic revolves around the war, which happens across 18 days. But as I wrote it, it actually became 19 voices, and that's the voice of Satyavati, the whole series of fourth-line poems, which just became a necessity because I needed a voice which would anchor the whole story together, someone who would tell the tale and not be... even if it is a very subjective take, someone who would not just have her story to say, but have an overview on all the doings and undoings and the battles for succession and power.
Okay, so can you say a little bit about the voice that weaves through, and then some of your selection, why you chose the voices that you did? You've mentioned about the minor characters that inspired you in the previous in the book that you mentioned just now.
Arun Kolatkar's book is mostly recited by Jarat Kuru, who is one of the she's a serpent mother who is witnessing her entire family and her entire community actually being slain. My initial plan was to end the book with her voice, but it didn't seem right at the end. I have a soldier ending the book.
So tell us about the voices that you have got in the book and how that's structured together.
Some of them are known voices. So Satyavati, who tells the story, is the mother of Vyasa, who is the acknowledged author of the Mahabharata. And I wanted to say, I kind of wanted to look at it through her eyes because, A, she's one of the women with a great deal of agency. And agency is a crucial question in the Mahabharata. Who has it? Who doesn't? What's done to obtain it? What it's like to lose it.
Power. Yeah.
Yes. And she's one of the few people. So, and in my look at the Mahabharata, I think what interested me was this whole question of the proprietorship of power, of who owns it, who, in a sense, leases it, who acquires it, who loses it, and what happens to those who never have it. What is their narrative? So just to read a little bit from one of the voices, one of those who have absolutely no power except the power of maybe a moral voice. This is Sovali. She's a handmaiden, and she's handmaiden to the Kaurava king Dhritarashtra's wife, Gandhari. Gandhari has a 20-month-long pregnancy, and the king becomes very worried that his children from Gandhari, the queen, will not be the firstborn of the next generation, and therefore he's going to lose, the battle for ascension. So he sleeps with this woman repeatedly, and it's what you would call sanctioned rape, because the priests and everyone in the kingdom is approving of this particular relationship. She's the only one who has no choice. Interestingly enough, this son grows up to be a dissident. He becomes a traitor, and he goes over to the side of his cousins, the Pandavas, who will be fighting against his own brothers. What I wanted to look at was what it is like for her to tell that story of the moments when she's nothing but a witness, but she's a witness on whom, you know, wrong is being done. Her body is territory that's being plundered, and that after, say, the harvest, after having the son, is just detritus. She doesn't matter anymore. She's never spoken of again. Oops.
So essentially she's a handmaiden who is raped by the king, yep, until she bears a son.
Yep. So this one is called Bedtime Stories for a Dasi's Son, and a Dasi is a handmaiden. 2. When the king decides to take you, the eyes arrive first, not his own, for he is blind. No, an unkindness of eyes, male and female and other, raptors that circle you, watching, weighing, measuring, probing and prying. An unkindness of eyes, each set different, yet so similar they could all be the same. Eyes that seem to have no tongues, no torsos either, though you will feel their beaks inside your head for the rest of your days, pecking your words, gnawing on your thoughts, spitting out syllables, stretching vowels, screeching and cooing in turn, praising and threatening. It is an honor, they crow, that you must strive to deserve. An honor we are so grateful to be spared. A great honor you must not avoid. You know this already. In all the years you have tried to remain unseen, tried to stay unbodied, even when present. For how could you forget your neighbor, the maid who fled, the maid who had reached the river, dived in and nearly crossed its waters when soldiers harpooned her through the neck, hauled her back, then slit her open like a common carp, nose to belly, and left her innards by the bank. For you were taught the tale of your great aunt, chosen by another monarch many moons back. Your great aunt, who managed to vanish, but returned when they fed her husband and her firstborn to a bonfire, feet first, and fed the remains, two tiny hands, a thigh bone, charred bowels, to red ants. An honor you cannot refuse, they call. As though you don't know that. When the king decides to take you, there is nowhere to run. The land is his, the rivers are his, the sky too. The birds dwelling there bemoan. When the king decides to take you, there is nowhere to hide. With earth and heaven and hell his turf. When the king decides to take you, no one comes to the rescue. The gods are his, myth and legend too, his own.
And that's just one part of that voice. Yeah. It goes on at some harrowing length, doesn't it? Can you tell us? You've given a voice to different characters who are not. They're not the main characters traditionally in the Mahabharata. Can you tell us something about the other characters? And why you've spoken, you've chosen a very different form for each voice as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can tell us a little bit about some of your selection, but also the form that you've chosen because it's a very, very, it's kind of an astonishing range of, it's very wide-ranging, the style and the form and the voice, actually.
When I began the book, there were two, conundrums. One was structure, and I found that, you know, almost accidentally with Satyavati coming up, and that was narrative voice, which punctuates the whole book. And the second was, and this kind of haunted me a bit, how do I sound like 18, that it was 18 then first, 18 different people, how can I be honest to them? Because the point was not to sound like me as much as possible, but to kind of just be a conduit for who these people could have been. And, you know, there are authors who do it brilliantly. My Name is Red by Orhan Pamuk. He becomes, I mean, as a narratorial voice, he becomes a tree, a coin, the color red. It's exhilarating. I didn't have those skills, but poetry is fantastic because it offers you just such a wide variety of, voices through tone and rhythm and tempo and structure. And what you can tell through, or the kind of mood or personality that you can convey through a Pontum is different from through a Sestina, is different from a Lande, is you know, extremely is completely in another place than a Padam, which is a devotional kind of a chant. So that was a huge tool. And what I did was channel the voices through forms, both existing ones from various traditions, whether the Rubai, the Pontum, like I said, the Sistina, the Glossa. There are sonnets. There's also things like the Siharfi, which is what you call the kind of invasion through the alphabet.
Oh, that one.
Yeah. And then there were ones that I can't say invented, because nothing's actually really invented, which I borrowed or refracted from choreography, for instance, which is very useful for conveying momentum.
Let's back up a bit. Okay. You've mentioned a whole range of different formal poetic forms. Mm. I mean, I'm always amazed as a non-poet how you manage to both convey a dramatic story in a character, but really channel it through very strict formal devices, which you've referred to the Pontum, the Lande, the forms that I've never heard of. Do you choose a form for the voice, or does it end up? How do you choose that form, and why does it have to be like that?
When I wrote Bearings, my first collection, it was basically form was just this great playground, and it was great fun. But it did not, apart from the choreography poems, there again where form was very much contingent on the source material. It was just for fun. With the Mahabharata, form became this major ally, and it's actually content that drives form for me.
Okay.
It's what the voice required, what it needed to be, which defined the form that I chose, which hopefully, was a sound choice. At least it needed to convince me first, and there are a couple there's only one poem that I actually threw out, but it did not sound faithful to the people that it needed to represent.
Okay, so you chose forms on the basis of the voice.
The people, yeah.
So can you give us some names of the forms? Yeah. Because there's a Japanese form that I've never heard of, and devotional, lots of things that I've never heard of. I've heard of sonnets.
Well, the Japanese form you mentioned, well, there's the tanka. Shunaka speaks in the tanka, but the one that's really recurrent is a variation of the haibun, which is a prose poem that ends with a haiku, and that seemed really, really appropriate for Satyavati because she is delivering an epic, a variant of an epic.
So that's a form where you have basically prose, but
prose
at
poetry
at the end,
yeah.
Each stanza is a haiku.
And the haiku does not refer directly to the events. It's a sort of coda which sums up either the moral or emotional undertone of that segment.
Yeah. So, for example, there's a form which I kind of when Kartika explains it to me, I have these kind of feelings of, you know, enlightenment is happening. But for example, there was one which is like a backstitch, which moves forward two and then back one and then forward two and back one. And there's this, it's amazing that this whole story is actually done through motifs. It's like a designed motif. Yeah. I think of it as a backstitch, by looping it that way, and then it ends up at the start again.
Yeah, exactly.
What's that called?
It's the pontoum.
The pontoum.
So, you know, lines 2 and 4 of the first quatrain become lines 1 and 3 of the next quatrain, so you end where you began. And I used it for Gandhari, who is the wife of Dhritarashtra, the blind king. She's forcibly wedded to him, but she chooses to blindfold herself as well. In the traditional kind of interpretation of her action, it's supposed to be the ultimate gesture of wifely devotion. I saw it as, and it's not just my interpretation, there are regional variants of this which also refer to this as an act of rebellion, as an act of disavowal, if you will, where she says, you know, if I have to be married to this man and waste my entire life, then I will not be responsible for what happens, neither to me nor to my children. And so I found the pontoum really useful for that, because this is a woman who lives in the past. Everything that happens to her is anchored to the past. So it's a very long poem, but I'll read just the beginning and the end, so that kind of, you know, brings it together. Oops, I need to find it first. I've got far too many bookmarks.
Page 151.
Thank you. No, 151 is different. Oh, that's you've got the
oh,
British.
Oh, I've got the previous one, sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's a page.
Yeah, I've got it. So it's called The Deadliness of Broken Things. If only they'd killed you when you were still a child, my brother, my almost son. There are times I think I have been walking with your grave these many years. Were you not the only one, the only being to know my name? Shakuni, my brother, I think all my sons could still live long and prosper. The Kuru would then bloom. But you'd known my being, my name, my true name, not Gandhari, the dead suffix to land I've become. So I prayed you'd live long, prosper, and doom Kurus who'd slain and drawn father, our brothers, then quartered Gandhar to dead annexed land. You became the day of ruin. You came undone, the sun torn from its seams. When our kin, our earth and skies were drawn and quartered at Bhishma's hands, they owned our eyes, the shattered skulls, the torn lungs, arms ruined and legs undone, sons crushed in live wombs, and eyes all over, unfurled, gouged, handless, shattered. Eyes that clamored for Bhishma's skull in single splattered tongue and never left our heads. Eyes haunted my womb and unfurled our hearts to gouge lost names. What else could they do? We are their last refuge. By father's splattered head and gashed tongue, I swore not to glimpse the world again. Eyes I bound in revenge, blindness was my last refuge. What could Bhishma do save praise his blind nephew's captive bride and name my bound, vengeful eyes, love's crown? Eyes the world glimpsed again no more. None had seen the sun in my twilight gaze, save you, captive kin of blind Dhritarashtra's bride, a wounded, brooding child who could scarce walk or speak. And then she goes on to recount the birth of her sons, her fear, because her brother, the only survivor from her clan, actually is the serpent, you know, in the bosom. He connives to have the entire clan destroyed as revenge for destroying their own clan. That's his own nephews, his sons, pretty much the whole world. And so she ends by you know, pleading to him to stop, something she'd not wanted him to do, but now that she would, because she herself has children and grandchildren and nephews, and she does not want to see this kind of internecine death. I knew we would not survive. Kinship, not death, not fire, and you would be our nemesis. The king pronounced a life away from Hastina, Indraprastha, new kingdom on barren land, for the five Pandav. The pronouncement of nemesis, the king does not see, but then he never did. For I know, distance from the Pandav will not turn barren the kingdom of my son's greed. And you'll not rest till he make light. More distant from insight and joy there'll never be, reigns, till it shatters earth and earth into a million eyes, till unrest and greed spill hamic light from our sons. If I could, I'd halt time, force him back to the day a million eyes reigned on Gandhar's earth to carve out your grave that I've been carrying for all these years, made heavier each day. I'd force time to halt, return, and I'd kill you myself when you were still a child.
There's always kind of silence that has to happen just after you finish a reading, but let's go on. That was the pantoum.
Yes.
Yes.
It's a Malay form.
A Malay form. And you've drawn on forms from, you know, lots of different traditions, but you've also made some up of your own, have you not?
You've
molded some
way.
Of your own. You've wrought some.
Yeah, I think things always exist in one form or the other. It's basically, you know, how you kind of appropriate them or rework them. And a lot of the forms which you say I've invented reference dance quite heavily.
Okay.
So I can't take the credit. Aunt Teresa could, or Steve Reich could even before her.
Okay, well, shall we... maybe we should talk about that now. It's my subject. There's actually... there's at the end of the book, there's a list of... acknowledgements and references, and actually quite unusually, I think, for a textbook, there's a large section which is simply dance and theatre, which you've acknowledged at the end of the book after your shorter bibliography. Yes. How does that? Why is there so much dance and theatre and some film? Acknowledged in this book? How does it influence what you've done?
It's kind of my first language. I don't have a literature background. I mean, I'm terribly, terribly ignorant. And what I see, what I breathe, what surrounds me is dance, as you know. And I think poetry and dance have a lot of things in common, but also have this great difference where dance is just so transient. I said once that it was a calligraphy written on water, because you see it and it will never be exactly the same again. No two performances are the same, as you know better than I do. But what it does to you, there's a way in which it goes into your body, in which your body absorbs it, which I think is extraordinary. And, you know, poetry does that, but in a very different way. There is the gift of return. There is the gift of permanence in a certain way. What they do have in common, I think, is structure as a bedrock, even when it's invisible. I mean, you know, when free verse may seem to be arbitrary, but it isn't. There's really structure behind it, and so it is for contemporary dance as well, even if it doesn't have a sort of recognized lexicon like ballet does or many traditions of classical dance. But it's great for momentum, for instance. I mean, it's just such a valuable tool for transposing momentum, for one. And the other thing is for, I think, contradictions. Dance does a great job of representing contradictions because you have different bodies on stage. There's a dialectic there, which is very useful to kind of transmute into text.
And how do you transmute that into text?
Well, it depends. There's, you know, there's poems like Constancy 5. Maybe you have the page number.
It's different from yours. Oh, yeah, it's near the end, isn't it?
It is near the end, but it also does not have a page. because, you know, it's one of the poems where we couldn't have a page, I think. A number, that is.
Wait.
Sorry, I've got stickers everywhere, but they don't seem to always work. Yep, got it. Eeks. Oh, we're bad at this.
This one.
Yes. Okay, could you show it? So, it's in grey and black typeface, and it's actually written as a duet, and it is two voices.
The type font is partly in grey and partly in black.
Yes, and it's written in such a way that there's nothing new about that. Philippe Nicolas has been, you know, doing two-toned poems for ages, and I'm sure many other poets have. But I wanted it to be also about two voices where they could exist independently, but they're also talking to each other. So it's one continuous poem, but it can also exist on stage as two people, two voices interacting. And it's part of the Constancy poems, which are actually the voices of the anonymous lovers and spouses of the soldiers who have to go to war. There's a whole series of that. And this is the fifth one. And it's a sort of evocation of the past and an acknowledgement of the end, because they're going to war.
Okay. Likewise, I think there are various forms like this. I don't know if you can see. It's kind of done in the shape of a kind of what?
Well, that was, again, movement. It's an ostinato. I mean, it is what I now know to be an ostinato, but I only knew it from certain dance works. Because, again, I know nothing about music, funnily enough, you know, like formal music. That's a concrete poem.
This is just a pure concrete poem. So there's a lot of shaping,
yeah,
visual
that
shaping.
That was meant to be a mausoleum, because, again, it's one of the constancies.
Here's a constancy.
That's a compound eye, because it talks about the body being reduced to a set of eyes when you're going to die.
And then there's the dome ones.
They're actually shields. That's a soldier's voice, so they're going off to war. To sort of.
So these are protective kind of.
Yes.
Cusps of some kind. Shall we show that there's a little piece of choreography? It's actually a piece that has been hugely influential on both of us in our separate way by coincidence. And you can maybe talk about how this dance actually gets transmuted into your poem.
Thank you.
20-minute section, and this is the end of that section.
And while we're waiting, that's Antarasa, the Kirchmacher, who's sort of the high priestess of composition, I think, and founder of the Rosas Company, so a Belgian Flemish choreographer who's been hugely influential. And the music is by Steve Reich. And it's called, this one's called Violin Face, which in Flemish, so the name of the dance piece that she's given is Violin Faza in Flemish.
So that was a particular influence on a particular poem here.
Well, yeah, there's actually been quite a few poems, shall we call it the Faza poems, but there's one particular one in... there's one particular one in Until the Lions, which is Constancy 6. It's the last of the choral voices. Before God, before the dead, before children, before a world, dance. Before the sea drowns, before clouds conflagrate, before the phoenix drops, before thorns flower, write. Before you leave, before I lose, before it rives, before they blaze, Ravel. Before you leave home, banish to a land named alone, before I lose my voice, voice that will roam spheres seeking yours. Before a border arrives language from love, marrow, and bone. Before words blaze through veins and jagged tongues of fire. Ravel wild cursives from a pledge. Retrieve its letters, wavels, abjads, and all. Send them to safety from lip to heart and lung. Before the sea drowns, gills clogged by a rain of blood. Before clouds conflagrate, scorch the seasons, rain, dark, light. Before the phoenix drops her song, sealing the casement to dawn. Before thorns flower and bronchioles and branches crowd airways. Write it all. Little stories, giant histories, a few myths. Tie them to cotton seeds so they fall in distant hands. Etch a copy on memory's palms, call it the human crease. Before God dies, smile trampled, 1,000 arms crushed underfoot. Before the dead return like moonlight, trailing white ash and regrets. Before children swap marbles for slugs and swallow darkness at meals. Before a world of straight lines and ironclad right owns your eyes. Dance. Dance on vanishing shores between night and half-light. Return. Return to nest like stacked spoons, lock chest with spine. Twine hip and thigh, knit 10 fingers, pearl the lips. Once more before the battle.
So that's obviously not related in terms of subject.
At all. She'd be horrified, I think. She's the most unemotional person I know.
But what was the imprint of the choreography on that particular poem?
The declension, actually. So you've got begin, movement, pivot, return, develop, pivot, elaborate, retrace, return. So if you see it...
Yeah. So it's like the starting point. It's like a statement, movement, return, and progress, and then return.
Yeah.
And then at some point you continue into a wider...
Yeah, but then you come back.
But then you come back. Yeah. So there you go. That's a choreographic... I don't know. I guess you have to say imprint on the form. For me, I'd say that maybe because I write about dance, I'm kind of more sensitized to this. It's what I do. But I find that when I've been reading the poems, there's a lot of... there's a few things that remind me of dance. One is there's a really, really strong physical sense of embodiment. There's lots of words that actually describe physical feelings and body parts and so on, even if some of them, are about crushed collarbones and ripped lungs and so on, which doesn't happen deliberately in dance.
Fortunately.
So there's a really powerful sense of actually that it has a physical communication, not just a verbal one, even though the medium is words. Two, I think there's because it's highly composed, that reminds me a lot of the kind of dance that I like. And there's quite a lot of movement. I sense there's a lot of dynamic range in it, and there's kind of a lot of musical dynamics of force and phrasing that I guess is inherent to poetry. There's one particular one which I feel like has a certain kind of movement, which again I only kind of really got when you pointed out what was happening. There's a poem where a character is completely set. You've described her as a killing machine. It's like vengeance is the only thing that the character does. And what the poem does is gradually march through the alphabet. It starts with a lot of words beginning with A, and then it shifts to B, and then C. And you don't really...
Verbs. Always verbs.
Always verbs, okay. Yeah. Verbs beginning... and it has a movement. I thought of it as like... moving across the terrain of the alphabet and kind of slaying letters as it went, leaving the, crushed bodies of these letters behind it. But there's a really inexorable movement there that it feels like moving across a space in an inexorable way.
Well, it's also a very complex character. It's two voices in one. There's the past, which represents memory, and there's the present, which is nothing but a killing machine, as you said. It's called Manual for Revenge and Remembrance. And so there's the revenge part, which is embodied by Shikhandi, the warrior, the princess reborn to gain justice which then shifts into vengeance, because there's also that question of what the liminality is between those two. And there's the remembrance, which, moves into various forms, but is essentially a recounting of everything that happened to this woman to make her become reborn, this killing machine.
Okay, I'm just conscious of time now, and I know you have to... I know you'd like to finish with a particular reading.
Mm.
Let's do that now.
Okay.
And then we'll have... a little bit of time at the end for questions.
One of the, perhaps not the stated intent of the book, but one of the things which became really important to me while I was writing the book was the multiplicity of versions of belief systems, of practices that the Mahabharata incarnates in so many ways. as Stephen would know, there's no one, again, I quote Ramanujan, who said there's no one version, which is why he always called it, he called it a telling. You know, there have been Mahabharatas written, spoken, transmitted in different regions in India. There's a Muslim Mahabharata, which was commissioned by Akbar. There are Mahabharatas in Indonesia and so on. And among these regional variations, one which struck me was the Tamilian one, the Paratavemba, which continues to exert a very strong influence on performing art practices today, on the transgender community today. So it's the story where it changes is during the battle. So there are the Pandavas and the Kauravas, the two sets of cousins who are fighting each other for supremacy over the land of the Kurus. And on the eve of the battle, a young man comes to the Pandava, you know, army and announces that he is actually the son of Arjuna, one of the generals, and the third Pandava, the star warrior of the Pandava clan. It turns out that he's actually Arjuna's firstborn, born of a night of love between Arjuna and a serpent queen, Ulupi. In most of the Mahabharatas that we read, this man fights bravely. The serpent king fights bravely and dies on the ninth day of battle. He's killed by another demon, and that's that. He dies like most of the sons of the Pandavas. In the Paratavemba, in the Tamil telling of the Mahabharata, he's asked to sacrifice himself through a ritual mutilation on the eve of the battle because the priests have discovered that that's the only way the Pandavas can win. One of five of their soldiers bearing certain ceremonial markings would have to kill himself, and no one else. The other people who bear the markings are Arjuna, their general, their star warrior, who shouldn't kill himself. Nobody wants that. Krishna, you know, the god advisor, who shouldn't be killed either. And then a couple of other people who can't be asked because they're now in the enemy camp. And Arjuna everyone thinks that the son is expendable. So the son, Aravan, says he will kill himself, but he wants to be married first. He wants to be mourned. He wants to be loved. He does not want to die a virgin. And all the women in the land refuse to wed and bed him because they do not want to become widows the next day. So Krishna, the god whose idea this was, says he will transform himself into a woman, marry Aravan, give him a night of love that he will never forget, and then mourn him as a man has never been mourned. So this is that poem. It's called the Jeremiad for the Debris of Stars. And this is God discovering what it is like to be a human being and actually...
As the woman.
Yes, as a woman, and experience sorrow, mortality, and injustice. A curse, a curse, a curse on you, a curse on you, a curse on all of you, gods, demons, sovereigns, oceans, planets, mountains, moon, fire, earth, on all you gaping stars, a curse on creatures of the night, of day, of trees, on this air, a curse on all that rises, that gleams, that shades, that raises, that invades. A curse on all that remains. For he breathes no more, Aravan breathes no more, no more hears, nor speaks, no more sings with the breeze. No more do his feet anchor the earth, no more do his cheeks kiss the sun's rowing fingers. No more does he taste the sandal, the musk of these breasts. No more does he savor nectar in the hollow of a neck. No, no more, no more will his skin warm my skin, shoulder to instep. No more will his hands map the journey of filaments from navel to pudendal cleft. No more can he rest his head between my legs. No more his mouth, no more his manhood. No more pulse, no more thought. No more Aravan. A curse on you, for he is no more, Aravan is no more, no more. He is no more than 32 slivers of flesh for Kali's tongue, offering for Pandava victory, no more than gashes on a head, a chest, a belly, nose, temple, the point, the sacred point between eyebrows, twin sets ripped of earlobes, lips, knuckles, elbows, wrists, shoulders, knees, insteps. Then 10 neatly sliced toes, yes, 32 slivers of flesh that imbrue the earth with geysers of unending, unfading ritual red, while the rest will be fed to Agni's hungry craw, his blazing crimson craw, nape of neck and clavicle, ribcage, breastbone, gizzard, spine and sinew, gullet and tongue and teeth, his burnished gaze, his voice, the river ripple of his voice, his smile, the color of summer noon. A curse on you, a curse on night, on last night, heedless violet-skinned night that sped towards dawn, flashing toe rings and anklets, night that ended my heart, ended most of my life. A curse on Kali, a curse on all heaven, a curse on any god that clamors offerings, any god that trades in blood and breath for blessings. A curse on them all of them, gods that revel in bloody mayhem and sacrifice 100 curses. A curse on Hastinapur, a curse on this feckless land, on all its kings, on the ancient house of Kuru with its parricidal kin. A curse on Bhishma for his dreadful vow, on Vyasa who kept Bharata's line alive. A curse on Dhritarashtra, on dead Pandu, on Gandhari and Kunti and their many murderous, thoughtless good deeds. A curse. A curse, a bigger, a viler, a direr curse on those 5 Pandava brothers. Bastards all, Yudhishthira, the pious eldest who sends his children to die for a paltry throne. Powerful Bhima, who watched all this injustice reign and killed only his cousins. The same curse, dark and vile and dire, on Duryodhana, the cause of this war. On Dushasana, next in line, evil disrober of women and all 98 siblings. Jealous, bitter blood to be spilled on Kurukshetra's sacred earth, sacred only to Brahmins or the living. Then Arjuna, oh, the bright, peerless Arjuna, precious to the gods. Arjuna, who fights behind Krishna's shield. Arjuna, who let his son, his firstborn, Aravan, take his place at Kali's altar, bleating he is helpless at every immoral turn. And a curse on you, Ulupi, mighty queen, grieving mother, a curse on you for not keeping him safe, for not keeping Arawan away. What use is free will is if it fetters breath, if it smothers pulse? So why must mothers permit sons to follow noxious fathers? But what curse could be worse than aching womb, than empty heart? What curse of mine could ever be worse, Ulupi? A curse, a curse, a curse on us. On you, Krishna, Lord of 14 worlds, a curse, a curse, the vilest of all curses on you, for these gods, these demons, sovereigns, oceans, planets, mountains, moons, for this fire, this earth, this heaven, for all these gaping stars, a curse on you. The foulest of curses, Krishna, for spinning this loathsome universe into light. For this war that raises countless men and beasts, hope and goodness, a war that parches land and sea and sky, the war that you willed into being, a curse on your dharma that changes shape and color and size to suit the wearer, your mutant, bootless justice and your lethal cosmic song. A curse, a curse on you. For this deadly master plan to ensure Pandava victory, the ruse to spare your cherished Arjuna. A curse on you for contriving Aravan's death, and a million curses I hurl at you, Krishna, for transmuting into maiden, into Mohini, into me. A curse for proffering this choiceless coupling, this heady grief. A million curses for your power, O God that creates, God that destroys, God that forgets, as God so easily do. A curse on me. A curse on me, for I live while Aravan lies unmoving, reduced to 32 slivers of flesh, to geysers of unfading ritual red. For while I breathe, he can no more dream, for while I speak, while his tongue is a mere blaze of flame. For while I walk, his legs are firewood on a pyre, while I taste air, he is just a name. While I dance, he is dead sacrifice, a curse on my breastcloth. His fingers can no more undo on my bracelets that will never mark his skin. On my eyes, for they behold Aravan no more, only carcass and bone. A curse on this gaze whose lust can stir him no more, on nails that will never graze his spine again. Hands that will not wind around his neck, fingers that need never entangle his. A curse on my breasts, for they will blossom in his palms no more, on my lost laughter that will not caress his lips again. A curse on this womb that will never bear his seed and watch it grow. And one last vicious curse on my transient woman's soul that will forget Aravan after this morning when it becomes male once more. For Krishna will not spare me a morsel of memory, not the comfort of mourning, nor the covenant of a married name. A curse on me.